Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly roundup of Utah news featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and today on the program, the Utah legislature reconvenes to try to override Governor Cox's veto of a bill barring transgender girls from female school sports. The outdoor retailer trade show is headed back to Utah despite a threat of boycott from some well-known brands. And an in-depth report examines how Utah boarding schools stripped Native students of their culture. Those and other stories in the lineup today. And joining me for this conversation, all via the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Kim Bohorquez. And Kim, thank you very much for being here. Good morning.
Thanks for the invite.
Of course, public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley is with us as well. And good morning to you, Brian.
Hi, Roger. It's nice to be with you again.
Yeah, thanks for joining. And Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke, I really appreciate your making time this morning, Robert. Thanks.
Absolutely. No better way to spend a Friday morning.
I love it. Listeners, a little bit later in the show, we're going to hear from Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner on the legacy of Indigenous boarding schools. Stick around for that. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, to begin with, Utah Governor Spencer Cox this week vetoed a bill that bans transgender girls from participating in female girls' sports. Immediately afterwards, legislative leaders said that they would call a special session to an override session to override that veto. And Kim, can we first talk about the veto itself? What was the rationale that Utah Governor Spencer Cox gave for vetoing this bill?
So the bill in question, HB 11, originally proposed a commission that would evaluate whether a transgender athlete could participate in a school sport. But during the last day of the legislative session, during the last hours before midnight, Senator Daniel McKay introduced an amendment that proposed an outright ban of transgender girls from participating in female school sports. And Governor Cox for years has been an ally to the transgender community, particularly when it comes to transgender youth. And in his lengthy veto letter, he said that he was concerned that this would send a message to transgender athletes that they aren't welcomed in the state. And he also mentioned that many studies have shown that transgender youth are more likely to have suicidal ideation and are more likely to attempt suicide compared to their other friends who are non-trans. And he was quoted in the letter saying that he just wants them to live. Yeah. And that was his main rationale for issuing a veto on this bill.
Originally that the margin by which this bill cleared the legislature, it indicated that there wasn't enough support for a veto override to overturn what Governor Cox had done in issuing this veto. Now, House and Senate leaders are saying that the votes are there to undo the governor's veto. What's the background there? Do we know if they really have those votes, Kim?
Yeah, so legislative leaders in the House and Senate have said that they have enough votes to override Governor Cox's veto. Since the governor vowed to strike down HB 11, as soon as it was passed on the last day of the legislative session, leaders have lobbied their colleagues to flip their votes in order to override his veto. And sources told our politics correspondent Brian Schott that lawmakers met this week to discuss an override session that's happening today, citing that they want to maintain the integrity of women's sports. But when I spoke to Troy Williams this week, who is the leader of Equality Utah, an LGBTQ advocacy group, he claimed that some lawmakers don't like the bill in general and are voting in favor of it because they are facing intra-party challengers in upcoming elections.
So basically, this is for those particular lawmakers that Troy Williams spoke to. This is a political maneuver, and they feel that they don't have a choice. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, that's what Troy Williams indicated to me.
I mean, for the veto override to happen, there has to be some people who voted, against the measure on the last day of the session to then Now they're going to vote for the veto override, and it'll be easy to see, you know, who made those changes, I guess. And but that's not something they're concerned about. They're concerned about the intra-party challengers, as you said. Governor Spencer Cox says that this impacts a very small number of students. In fact, just 4 students across the state of Utah who are competing in transgender sports. He says in his letter that they're, you know, they're not winning championships, they're not winning awards, they're just enjoying sports with their friends. And I guess, can you, Kim, this might be, this is going back in time a little bit, but what do the sponsors of HB 11 say about their rationale for the ban? Meaning, why do they say that they're in favor of a ban like this, especially when there's not much of, you know, this isn't much of an issue in the state of Utah in terms of numbers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, repeatedly, lawmakers who support this bill have said that they want to maintain the integrity of women's sports. And a lot of them have pointed to an example of a college swimmer who is a transgender woman, Leah Thomas, you know, who recently won an NCAA tournament. And, you know, but at the same time, Governor Cox has argued that passing this legislation wouldn't impact college sports. You know, it would impact, you know, middle school students, high school students. But yeah, their rationale has always been to protect girls who want to participate in women's sports, who believe that there is an unfair advantage to allowing trans women or trans girls to participate.
Yeah, and then as you said, the governor says he's concerned especially about students feeling accepted, about the data, you know, on the risk for suicide. I'm assuming, Kim, that there's some pretty intense campaigning that's happening ahead of today's special session, from those who are both for and against the veto override. When is all of this playing out? And we know it's today. You know, what's the sort of time frame here?
Yeah, so there's actually a rally that I found out about this morning, happening at noon. The sponsor of the bill, HB 11, and I believe that the Eagle Forum will be holding a press conference talking about, you know, gaining support for letting HB 11 pass. And today at 1, lawmakers are meeting at the Capitol for the override session. And then at 2, Governor Cox will start a special session to talk about the legal challenges that HB 11 could bring if it were to pass.
Okay. And that is expected, right? I mean, we are expected to see lawsuits as a result of this, and that's what the governor is going to talk about if this special session overrides his veto. I'll just mention that you mentioned the Eagle Forum. They are a conservative lobbying group, conservative interests group that wields a fair amount of power. Robert Gerke, let's bring you into the conversation here, a news columnist. This has been kind of, you know, this has been playing out over quite a few weeks, but then, you know, we had the last day sort of change in language introduced by Senator Dan McKay, and then the adoption of this, and then the veto, and now we have the veto override session. This has been called a classic wedge issue, and Kim pointed to that political aspect of this that Troy Williams from Equality Utah was citing. Is that what's happening here? Is politics, or you know, what? Why are some lawmakers changing their mind and deciding to vote for overriding this veto when they actually voted against the bill?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to be politics on the surface. The bill that they voted against hasn't changed. The process that they underwent to pass this bill hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is that since the session ended, they've been getting beat up by conservative groups, like you mentioned, the Eagle Forum, but there are others. And you know, there's their concern for their political future. So, you know, this gives them some cover. If they come back and override this veto, then they can go out and campaign in November and say that they, you know, voted to stop trans sports. And it seems like pretty craven political gamesmanship. And I think it's unfortunate that these kids are being used as pawns in this political game to prop up some legislators' political future. You know, but I think that's where we are. And I think you're going to see most, if not all of, well, the vast majority of Republicans who voted against this are going to end up changing their votes today. And I think we should pay attention and take note of who they are. And because I think it speaks to their character or lack thereof.
Robert, this is, this issue, it's a relative, as far as it being a wedge issue goes, it's a relatively new issue as a wedge. The school sports, part of this is what I mean. Is there a time in the future when the state may, or should, from your perspective, address this? Or is it better left to, say, individual school districts or, principals, students, student athletes, et cetera?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, the Utah High School Athletics Association has had a policy in place for, I believe, 2 years now, maybe three, that says that kids who are assigned a boy gender at birth can compete as girls after they undergo a year of hormone therapy. And that hormone therapy is specifically designed to eliminate any physical advantages or the physical advantages that boys might have in terms of strength and so forth.
Right.
The policy has worked. I mean, as you mentioned, as the governor mentioned, as Kim mentioned, there are three boys and one girl who are competing, under this policy. And so, we're going to this extreme length to prohibit any, prohibit these transgender girls from competing with females in the future without really establishing that there is a problem. And as Kim mentioned, they all point to this University of Pennsylvania swimmer, Leah Thomas. This bill doesn't do anything to affect college athletics. The college athletics policies will remain the same after this bill passes. All it does is affect these teenage kids, age 14 to 17, 18 years old, who are competing in high school athletics. And again, we haven't seen a problem. So yeah, I mean, I think what's driving this clearly is this sort of national wedge issue. This, the conservative Republicans see this as a winning issue for them in elections. And so they're going to persecute children to get that political advantage. They don't care. And I think it's distasteful, but it also puts taxpayers on the hook. As you mentioned, the special session, they're going to appropriate $500,000 to defend the potential litigation. Everybody, even those who support this bill, recognize that there's going to be litigation. Senate President Stuart Adams says he fully anticipates that the courts will block this policy from taking effect because that's what they've done in the 11 other states where this has passed. And so we're buying ourselves a lawsuit. We're paying $500,000 to buy ourselves a lawsuit. And we're going to be hurting these kids who frankly aren't hurting anybody. Like the governor said in his letter, they just want to belong to something. They just want to play sports. And we should be encouraging that, I think, and not discouraging it, not banning it for anybody. So yeah, it's a pretty sad example. I don't think it speaks well to the legislature, generally speaking. As you mentioned, they spent a year trying to negotiate a policy, came to something that they thought they had agreement on. And then, the right-wing groups like the Eagle Forum come in and upend this. Senator McKay upends this with this last-minute scheme that they came up with, that they concocted. And they're trying to avoid political fallout by both waiting until the last hours of the session to pass the bill, and now, covering their butts by trying to override the governor's veto. It's distasteful, and I think they should be ashamed. As I wrote in my column this week, they should be ashamed of themselves.
Robert, just one other aspect of this that I think is interesting is, speaking of the impact on sports, there's the potential that I think Andy Larson wrote about this, that the state of Utah and Salt Lake City, the Utah Jazz, could lose the 2023 NBA All-Star Game over this bill because the NBA has done something similar in the past. And other events are, of course, in question as well as a result of this. Do you think that that's weighing on lawmakers? Maybe that's not a question you can answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should. And we have seen with the legislature at times that money talks. It's the only thing that gets their attention. The lives of kids don't matter as much as dollars. And so, you could see a scenario where Utah loses the NBA All-Star Game or the first round of the NCAA basketball tournament next year. Visit Salt Lake has expressed concerns about what it might mean to the convention and tourism business. And this has happened in other states. You mentioned the NBA All-Star game in 2017, I guess, over a transgender bathroom bill that they passed and then repealed. And once they repealed it, they got the game back. So there will be repercussions of this beyond the impact on the kids. But I generally speaking, try to maintain the focus on the kids and the fact that, you know, this is not a problem that needs to be solved today, but they're going to, you know, try to solve it with in sort of the most abrasive, you know, coercive manner that they can.
Robert Gerke, thank you for this. I want Kim Bohorquez, before we wrap up on this topic, is there anything, you know, that we are missing from the story other than the ending, obviously, which we will learn, well, the kind of ending, I guess. There's lawsuits to come this afternoon. But anything from this reporting that you want to highlight?
Yeah, you know, I should mention that in his veto letter, Governor Cox said that he really feared that if HB 11 were to pass, that it could potentially bankrupt the Utah High School Activities Association. You know, because as Robert mentioned, you know, they will face litigation. It's very possible that they will face litigation because of this bill.
Okay. So many facets to the story. And Kim Bohorquez, thank you very much for your reporting on this. With that, we are going to head to our first break in the show. There is still more to come. When we come back, we will talk about the return of outdoor retailers to Salt Lake City. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Kim Bohorquez, public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Wrap-Up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or by tweeting them to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. It somehow feels like the outdoor retailer trade show left Utah much further back in time, but it's only been a few years, you know, however we've had pandemics and wars to contend with afterwards, and maybe that's changing our perception of time, but anyway, remind us what this trade show is and, you know, when they left our state and why.
Yeah. Outdoor Retailer, you know, hosted the biggest trade show in Utah up until 5 years ago. And its members are, exhibitors are, companies like the REI, Patagonia, the North Face, just, literally hundreds of others. And they convened in Salt Lake City twice a year for a summer and winter show, brought tens of millions of dollars in economic activity to Salt Lake City. But when Salt Lake City's contract was up with the Outdoor Retailer Show back in 2016, that was when the state's leaders were really pushing for the rescission of the newly created Bears Ears National Monument. Right. And given the state's unwillingness to back down, the leaders of this industry said, well, we'll take our show to another city that's more in line with our values. And that city happened to be Denver. Right. And, it turns out that, hey, a lot of these companies actually preferred Salt Lake City. It's a lot less expensive. Logistically, it's an easier place to work with than Denver. And probably more importantly, Salt Lake City's outdoor recreation destinations are basically in our backyard, whereas for Denver, it's quite a bit farther out, an hour or two drive to get to some of the ski areas. Interestingly, the Denver's contract came up this year after a five-year run, and interestingly, it's occurring at the very time when the Bears Ears Monument and the Grand Staircase have been put back in place by a new president, Joe Biden, and now the state is sitting on this, or state's leadership, I should say, is sitting on this proposal now to take the Biden administration to court to undo those monuments,
right,
to basically shrink them back down to where Donald Trump, President Trump, had put them back in 2017. The timing is so fascinating to me.
Right.
And the state, yeah, so the Governor Cox was not willing to back down from this threat of a lawsuit, which has not been filed yet. So many of these big players are not happy with Outdoor Retailers' decision to bring the show back to Utah. So on Wednesday, they announced what they're doing. And it appears to me that Salt Lake City's mayor, Aaron Mendenhall, played a really important behind-the-scenes role in getting the show back to Salt Lake City. And in her messaging on Wednesday, she, you know, pointed out that, you know, the values of Salt Lake City, you know, aren't the same as the rest of the states. Many Salt Lake City residents are extremely supportive of President, you know, Barack Obama's designation of Bears Ears. Mm-hmm. And it, you see everywhere in our town, you see, you know, these lawn signs, "I stand with Bears Ears." You know, so, but.
Right, Brian. I think
Minnesota has a big problem. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that it is interesting that in there, I mean, Outdoor Retailers, the group that owns and operates the trade show, in their statement about, you know, coming back, they lauded, they said that they, you know, they singled out the mayor of Salt Lake City, Mayor Aaron Mendenhall. They said that her values align with their own, trying, I guess, to sort of distinguish between the state and the city itself. You know, earlier you said that many of the companies preferred Salt Lake City because of the fact that, you know, it's cheaper and is closer to those outdoor recreation, sort of where you can demonstrate equipment and so on. But there are a number of companies, you know, some big brands that are involved in outdoor gear and clothing and the like, and they have the opposite perspective. And can you talk about that? That there are some groups that are now sort of threatening a boycott?
Here's where this comes from. What they're saying, and this is, you know, Patagonia, they manufacture really, you know, high end apparel, is kind of leading the charge on this. And what they're saying is, the conservation of landscapes is critical to their industry because that's where their customers go put their products to use. And, you know, if we're not protecting landscapes, we're undermining the outdoor industry, which over the last 25 years has become very important to Utah. In some ways it's central to Utah's brand. It's very much connected to its attractiveness as a place to move businesses to, for example. And so their feeling is, well, if Utah is going to actively work to undermine protections for these amazing landscapes like Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, then we shouldn't be hosting our trade shows there. That's kind of their argument. Well, so Aaron Mendenhall is making a much different case. What she said at her press conference on Wednesday was that, hey, you know, the outdoor industry could have a lot more influence if they stayed in Utah and continue doing trade shows here and engage policymakers in Utah at that high state, you know, the state level, rather than, you know, just talking among themselves and talking to sympathetic politicians in another state in Colorado, actually sitting down with, you know, rural, you know, lawmakers from Utah to understand their perspective. And, you know, I've been to a number of events where Governor Cox, you know, directly addressed this issue, and he feels like the state's getting an unfair shake. You know, that the state wants to preserve these landscapes. It's just they don't want to do it with, you know, quote unquote, federal overreach.
I just to interject for a second on the city and the county. I mean, both Mayor Mendenhall and Mayor Jenny Wilson at the county level, they are both, of course, eager to get this trade show back because of the amount of spending that happens, the amount of money that it brings in. Correct?
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. It brings in maybe last it was here in 2017, it was bringing in $45 million a year through these two shows. You know, thousands of people would be coming into this 3-day show twice a year. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of money. And the thing is, the pandemic has completely transformed that show. And so it might never be as big as it used to be because People, I think a lot of these industry representatives discovered that, hey, we don't really need to go to those, spend a lot of money and go to those shows. We can get connected with each other through other means. And participating in these shows is very expensive. And Denver turned out to be a fairly, relative to Salt Lake City, at least, expensive place to host these shows. And I mean, these companies have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in their displays, and then they have to store them, you know, for 6 months, before the next show. It's a lot of money, and so I think a lot of these companies are rethinking whether they even need to keep participating anyway, just from an economic standpoint. And then you throw the politics of it in. It's like, for some of these companies, they're probably just going to stay away.
It's interesting,
but it's clear that Mayor Wilson and Mayor Mendenhall both. Both of them are very supportive of the monument designations, and are also, I think they've made a very good case that these companies could, really advance their interests in Utah if they did come to the show and engaged in a dialogue.
Wow. You mentioned the fact that there's the lawsuit pending. The lawsuit is, again, to change, among other things, sort of national monument designations, but also conceivably to challenge the law underpinning those national monument designations.
Yeah.
That is something that big outdoor industry groups are especially concerned about. And they sent a letter to the governor, correct, saying this is our major concern. Wondering, though, I mean, does it undercut their argument when they are bringing the trade show back? I guess it's that some of those companies aren't joining. It's interesting. It's sort of a bizarre dynamic.
You're right. I think it's really hard for these companies to look at the state, appropriating millions of dollars, hiring this law firm, Consovoy McCarthy, to sue the Biden administration over this. It's really hard for them to say, oh, yeah, Utah's acting in good faith when they're going to, they not only want to take the monuments down. I mean, taking the monuments down, that's only a short-term victory for they need to dismantle the Antiquities Act so future presidents can't come back and designate big million-acre monuments again.
That's their argument.
That's their argument. And Consovoy made that specific case in their proposal to Attorney General Sean Reyes to get this business. This is going to be a very lucrative contract for them. But that said, the lawsuit, here we are, months after these monuments have been redesignated, no lawsuits filed, and I'm beginning to wonder if they're actually going to go through with it.
I was going to ask you if you thought that was actually coming down the pike or not. And it's funny, we were just talking earlier about the news columnist in for a second, Brian. We were talking about the NBA All-Star Game and whether or not it would stay in Utah after this bill on transgender student athletes. This is another example of something similar, but the idea being, for at least from the city and county's perspective, like, no, actually, you should work from inside the state. Robert Gerke, I want to get your voice in on this. What do you think of what's happening here? I mean, the power of protest, but also there's the power of the conference itself in these places. I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm a little cynical on this. I think they're looking for a rationalization for coming back, because from people I talked to, the Denver event was problematic. Like Brian said, one of the biggest parts of the Outdoor Retailer Festival was that you could do these demo days and take the gear out and test it out on the mountain or, on the trail. And it's just a lot more challenging to do that in Denver. And I think, as Brian also noted, the expense of being there. I think hands down, Salt Lake's a better location for them. And so they had to come to a way that they could come crawling back, I guess, while maintaining some of their dignity. So I'm happy to have them back. I think I liked the festival. I thought it was really good for the economy and the community and put us on the map in terms of our outdoor recreational opportunities. I do kind of see where Patagonia and others are coming from, saying that, we left because on principle, we left with a purpose, and we didn't have not done anything to achieve that purpose.
Yeah,
but I think it was also a little naive to think that the state was suddenly going to do a 180 on something as sort of ingrained in our in the state's DNA is the hatred for these monuments, or in the legislature's DNA at least. And so welcome back. I mean, I'm glad to have him.
Right. Robert, you talked about it being like you'd called it a festival, and it does have that sort of festival atmosphere vibe. Brian Maffley, I wanted to ask just if the trade show itself is significantly altered by the fact that a number of these companies won't be participating. Will it be something different than that kind of atmosphere that Robert Gerke is describing there?
Yeah, absolutely. A festival is a good way to describe it. There's parties all over town, and there's also a lot of events geared toward discussions about land management, as well as the business end of producing and marketing outdoor gear. But then, if you take out some of these big players who really provided a leadership role in the show, especially the North Face and Patagonia and REI, three of the loudest voices in basically boycotting, I think it's going to be a much smaller show, which is in some ways kind of defeats the purpose of the show, but in other ways it will still serve its function. Right. And one thing I'd like to point out, though, is when they pulled out of here 5 years ago, what did it accomplish? I mean, Utah is as anti-monument as ever. So it's like, okay, you pulled out. I don't know. It's like, economic sanctions against Russia. what are they really accomplishing? And maybe there's a case to be made, I think, that Aaron Mendenhall and Jenny Wilson put forward, that if you are here, you'll have a lot more influence.
Robert Gerke, go ahead.
If I could, I just have a slightly different take on sort of the future of the show, because when the show began, North Face, REI, Patagonia were sort of the behemoths of the outdoor industry, and they still are. But there are so many companies now that are, startups, new companies that have cropped up in the last 5 years, 10 years, that I think there will be, this will provide them a stage and a venue where they can sort of emerge. Not that those big companies aren't big, and not that they don't matter, but I think there are, the industry has gotten so much bigger and more diverse than it used to be, that I think there still will be a critical mass to make a really good festival.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm so sorry. I don't want to cut you guys short, but Brian, I wanted to ask you about another story altogether that's kind of cursorily related. I think that we're going to be really low on time to do it, so you may have to just sort of summarize. And it's this this fact that there is a former Republican Representative Mike Noel, I can never remember how to pronounce his name. He was a big player in sort of the public lands policy. At the state level, and there's this story that has to do with a stalking injunction that Noel got against a critic of his, but that injunction hasn't held up. Can you sort of, I don't mean to ask you this in a 30-second soundbite, but a quick soundbite, tell us what happened here.
Representative Mike Noel is a Republican of Kanab. It remains a pretty important player in land use decisions and proposals in his home county of Kane County. And he became a central figure in this controversial proposal for a frack sand mine outside of Kanab a couple of years ago. The whole proposal fell off the table. But back then, it was a very heated matter, and he took out a stalking injunction against one of his critics, who would appear at the same public meetings as him, and they would, kind of get into it, and it all seemed kind of like normal politics, really. People with different points of view, but Mike Noel was able to get a injunction against this guy. His name's Will James. He was a tour operator whose livelihood depended on, land conservation, really, in a beautiful place like Kane County. And the Court of Appeals, when they reviewed the case, which Will James argued pro se, meaning without a lawyer.
Yeah, just himself.
And found that there was, yeah, found there's basically no basis for any kind of injunction against this man. And they've, you know, sent the matter back to the district court in Kanab to, you know, basically throw the injunction out against this guy.
Wow. Yeah. It's an interesting story, Brian, and I would use it for my underplayed story, except for we've already talked about it, and I probably shouldn't have opened up that can of worms right then. But we do now need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week to save time for a conversation with the Salt Lake Tribune's Courtney Tanner about Indigenous boarding schools. And Brian, why don't I give you a first jab at it? What do you got?
Well, I just really love this story. I think it was Jordan Miller wrote it about a study out of BYU concerning how elk during hunting season seem to know that if you get off public land onto private land, you have a better chance of surviving.
Right.
And yeah, I just got I got such a laugh out of it. And I'm so glad Jordan wrote the story. But it's about how big game animals have somehow know that there are places of refuge on the landscape when
hunting season begins.
Deer season or hunting season begins in mid-October. How they know, who knows?
They're reading the newspaper. Yeah. I don't know. It is really pretty amazing story. Thanks for that, Brian. Robert Gricke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Brian beat me to that one. I just love the idea of an elk having an alert set up in his iPhone or something. It's like, oh, time to move. So I'll go with another one. Palak Jaiswal had a story that posted this morning looking at the origins of Holi, the festival of color. You probably every year see the pictures of people with the color smeared on their face and celebrating. It's this Indian holiday. And she looks at the origins, the meaning of it, and whether, you know, kind of gets to the issue of whether this is cultural appropriation or celebration. And so it's worth looking at. Wow. I learned something from it. So check it out.
Check it out at sltrip.com. It's also where you can find everything else that we have been talking about. Brian Maffley and Robert Gricke, both with that paper, the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Yeah. See you later, guys.
See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
There's still more to come on the show. After a break, we'll take a look at the history of Indigenous boarding schools in the state of Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and now on the show we will turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. As part of an in-depth report, Courtney and her colleagues delved into the legacy of Indigenous boarding schools in Utah. Take a listen. Courtney Tanner, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. You know, we are expecting sometime in the near future the release of a report by the U.S. Department of the Interior on the history and legacy of Indigenous boarding schools in the United States. And these were schools that forcibly removed hundreds of thousands of Native American children from their communities all over the country for more than 150 years. In anticipation of that review, you and your colleagues at the Tribune dug into the troubled story of these institutions here in Utah, and actually maybe we'll come back to this, it's just the start of a larger project. Before we zero in on the individual stories of people and how they experienced these schools, can you kind of give the zoomed out view? How many of these schools were there in Utah, and where were they?
Yeah, as we did our research, we found 8 of these schools, and as far as we know, that's actually a new number being put on this. You know, previous reports have said 5 or 6, and we discovered 8 wow. in looking through like old federal records. And they were spread out throughout the state. Most people know about the Intermountain School in Brigham City up in the north,
right.
But there were several in southern Utah and in central Utah, and there were 2 on the Ute Indian Reservation that is kind of in the eastern corner of the state.
Yeah, White Rocks and Randlett were the names of those 2 schools. The first of them opened in 1874. 3 of these institutions are still in operation today, though there have been some significant changes over time. And again, nearly a 150-year history here in the state of Utah, in fact. And you and your colleague, Alistair Lee Bitsoy, also Sheila McCann, you uncovered stories of abuse of you know, overtly racist language. In terms of what the objectives of these schools were, the people who founded and ran these schools saw themselves as reformers, basically, as doing good by trying to forcibly assimilate the indigenous students. Can you talk about the different forms that that forced assimilation took? I mean, Courtney, in addition to forcibly removing children from their communities, it was sometimes, for example, schools where forced labor was happening, among other things. Is there any sort of, I know it's hard to kind of broadly encapsulate the experience of all of these different schools, but in terms of what forced assimilation might look like, can you talk about that?
Right. And that's, you know, the model of these schools, you know, the earliest ones that opened. I mean, you can think back to kind of the motto of the Carlisle School, which is really similar to the ones in Utah, which was kill the Indian, save the man. And that is kind of the idea that these schools had with these children. So as you stated, you know, they were forcibly removed from their homes. You know, there are these records that talk about parents objecting and not wanting to send their kids. And the government would withhold rations from them, would, you know, take action against them, send the police to their homes. And then the kids, you know, were removed from those situations and placed in these boarding schools where, you know, they had their hair cut, they were forced to wear uniforms, they were forbidden from speaking their language. And as you mentioned, there's this whole part of it too with forced labor. I mean, these kids were essentially farming and sewing and doing household work and being taught to do those as careers. I mean, that was kind of the motivation of the school too, is that these kids would come away from the school and then engage in kind of lower income jobs essentially in society.
Right. And that aspect of, you know, cultural suppression was striking to me, and language suppression, that may have been a kind of unifying dynamic here, that, you know, as soon as you came to these schools, you weren't allowed to speak your language or to exhibit any of your culture in the name of assimilation. Your reporting, the reporting that all three of you did, it has too much to go into for us to cover here. And there are a lot of experiences from different eras. The story that you all wrote leads off with some commentary by Mark Maryboy explaining his experience in one of these facilities. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just telling us who Mark Maryboy is and some of the experience that he described at the boarding school that he attended.
Right. Yeah. Mark Maryboy is a leader in the Utah Dine Bikia organization that kind of represents Native American voices, particularly around supporting the Bears Ears Monument. He is also a former San Juan County Commissioner, and he was forced to attend one of these schools when he was a young boy. He thinks he was around like 7 or 8, and he went with his little brother Herbert, who was about a year younger than him. And his experience, you know, the way he worded it was pretty horrific. He would lie in bed at night when all the lights were turned out in the dormitory and just kind of wait for the older kids to beat him up. He remembers, you know, fists just kind of flying out of the dark every single night. And he just kind of sat there with anxiety, and he could hear the same thing happening to his little brother. They were just kind of pummeled by these older kids. And he reported it to the staff, who he says, you know, didn't do anything about it. And part of him also, it should be stated, doesn't really blame the older students necessarily. I mean, obviously this was this traumatic experience, but he says because of the way the school operated and kind of erasing their culture, that they grew angry, and this was an outlet for them to kind of release that anger. So it's this kind of traumatic cycle that he went through there. And eventually he and his little brother ran away and walked home in the middle of winter and, you know, kind of begged their parents not to send them back.
Wow. I mean, the amount of effort that you can imagine it taking at that as a kid to run away and leave the school you're at and get all the way back home is
right.
Fascinating.
And, you know, he's 7 or 8 years old, walking miles in the winter with his little brother.
Yeah. He has a quote in your article. It's abuse is the hardest thing to deal with. It weighs on your mind for the rest of your life. In fact, one piece of what you're reporting talks about is a desire for many people who have experienced abuse at these facilities, you know, who are still living, is to receive some sort of mental health assistance, or at least that's, you know, one group is advocating for that. Can you talk about that?
That's right. One of the delegates for the Navajo Nation Council is suggesting that with this investigation from the federal government, along with, you know, what the Salt Lake Tribune is trying to uncover, that mental health resources be offered, that, you know, it's really hard to bring up this trauma and this pain and to talk about it without having resources there as kind of a support system. So he's saying, you know, don't bring this up if you're not going to help us, if you're not going to provide anything, if the federal government's not going to come in and, you know, provide resources for them like therapy.
There's a sort of central question that one of the, you mentioned them already, Yuta Dene Bekea, the group that, well, they have offered to help the federal government with their investigation into boarding schools. And I can't remember whether or not they were taken up on that offer. But one of the questions that they want to see answered, and in fact that the Tribune is committed to digging into further, is who benefited financially from the operation of these institutions and how that kind of worked. And do you want to talk about the reporting that you all are slated to do? This is something that is grant-funded and you will be doing for a period of time.
Yeah, and I should say there's really so many avenues to go forward with. This first story is really just kind of an overview of these eight schools, where they existed, you know, kind of just touching base with some of the experiences at them. But there is so much to dig into going further. As Yuta Dene Bekea brought up, you know, who did benefit from these? I mean, there were churches involved, the federal government, the state government, you know, who was kind of making money, who was profiting off of these schools. You know, we hope to kind of look into each of the schools more and talk to more folks that went to the schools and kind of the lasting impact today. Honestly, this continues to haunt generations of Indigenous people.
Courtney, before we wrap up here, I kind of want to talk about burials, because that was in many ways where this review of Indigenous boarding schools got started at the federal level, was after a mass grave was uncovered at a boarding school in Canada. Do we know, Courtney, you know, about how many children might be buried at or near Utah's Indigenous boarding schools? I mean, I know that we know it's likely that there are burials. Can you talk about that aspect of this?
This is a really hard question to answer, and one that, you know, we're working on. And as you mentioned, you know, the federal government's report is supposedly focused on that. We'll see. That's expected to come out at the start of April. So we'll see if that kind of helps as well, put a number on that. We know that the school that was just outside of Panguitch, where Paiute children went, the tribe there believes that there are 12 bodies that are buried there, and Utah State is going to help with some ground penetrating research. They're kind of in the midst of signing a memorandum of understanding there. But in combing through all the federal records too, what was interesting, you know, these records, it's worth saying that these records come from a viewpoint that supports the methods of the school. So it's kind of this racist, paternalistic perspective. But they list from the start of the schools here in Utah from the 1870s up until 1930, which doesn't capture the full scope of the schools. But every year they have reports for these schools that were open. And in the Uinta Basin, the two schools that we mentioned there in White Rocks and Randlett, from these reports, I was able to count 50 deaths of students between just those two.
Wow. Courtney, can I ask, you know, you mentioned the records, where you're actually doing the research. Is it National Archives? Who holds these records today? And, you know, you're pouring through them. You have fascinating quotes by the federal agents in charge of different areas and reporting back. Where are you finding these records?
These records are really hard to find. I can't overstate that. That has been probably the trickiest part of this project, is that this history is really not in history books. You know, it's not just flip open a page and here's what happened in Utah's Indigenous boarding schools. So what we're looking at is these federal records that were given to the Department of Interior every year from these schools. And even those are kind of scattered throughout. So some of them are on the Department of Interior's website, some are not. You know, there are gaps in years that you can like try to find on Google Books. And it's kind of honestly this mess of hodgepodge of trying to like put this together. And what's really crucial with that is knowing, you know, what perspective these reports come from and trying to find the Indigenous voices, those who actually experienced what happened there.
Wow. Courtney, you know, we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that three of these schools are actually still open. And I'm wondering if, you know, there's the long history, the 150-year history of these institutions that we've been talking about. But are these institutions that are still open, do they still have that same sort of ethos of, you know, you described the Carlisle Indian School motto. I mean, are they still engaged in that kind of activity, or are they quite different than they used to be?
Yeah, I think finding out that three of these schools were still open was actually really surprising to us and to readers. Honestly, that was like a big takeaway for folks commenting on the story. They don't operate the same, which is good. If they were, you know, that would be very worrisome. There are still people, you know, raising questions about them. So it's not to say that everyone believes they're perfect, but from what we know, the schools operating today are trying to infuse Indigenous culture and lessons into their schoolwork. So kind of taking really the opposite approach of the early boarding schools.
Almost making it like a badge of pride that these are Indigenous schools.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. Wow. And that's such it's a complete reversal from that history that you've described. Courtney, you know, do we know whether or not you talked about the federal review that's coming out in April? I'm wondering if we know how much work federal investigators have been doing inside of Utah, or, you know, in relation to the Utah boarding schools. Have you heard about to what extent they have been conducting their review?
Yeah, and it's not really clear so far. They're being a little hush-hush. You know, we reached out to the department before we published this story to see kind of where they were at with their report, if they were still, you know, anticipating releasing that on that April 1st deadline that they had given themselves. Because like we said, you know, this is really hard history to find, but we haven't really heard back. They weren't able to confirm whether or not that report was coming out or not on that day. So I guess we're kind of just going to wait and see and you know, we'll keep digging in here.
Yeah. And the digging that you've done already is really remarkable reporting. I will direct listeners to check out yours, Courtney Tanner, Alistair Lee Beatsoy, and Sheila McCann's report on this at sltrib.com. The report is called Assimilated: How Utah Boarding Schools Stripped Native Students of Their Culture. Again, it's at sltrib.com. And Courtney Tanner, really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about this today.
Thanks so much, Roger.
And that does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.